My name is Laura Bayless, and I work here in the Department of Education. It's a pleasure to welcome you to today's Brown Bag Lunch Lecture, entitled Creating National and International Identities, the Futurist Exhibitions at the Venice Biennale Under Fascism, 1928 to 1942. This lecture is actually based on my master's thesis, which I finished last May at Hunter College, so I'm delighted to be able to share it with you. What I'm going to be discussing is the relationship that developed between the futurist artists and the fascist regime in Italy in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, and how they put their aesthetic and political ideologies on display at the Venice Biennale, or the International Exhibition of Art of the City of Venice, in those decades. Certainly, it's a lot to cover in just 40 minutes, so what I will focus specifically on is, one, a brief background of the Biennale, and I've tried to kind of visually illustrate these 4 points in this slide. This is a picture of the inauguration of the Biennale in 1895. Two, the agendas of the futurists and the fascists, and this is a group of the founding members of the futurist movement. Three, how the two groups used the Biennale exhibitions from 1928 to 1942 as a cultural platform to cultivate and challenge the meanings of Italy's aesthetic and national identity at home and abroad. And these are posters kind of bracketing those years that the Biennale was under the fascist administration. And four, how the futurist style of aeropittura, or aeropainting, exemplified by this work over here, of the 1930s and 40s echoed the regime's rhetoric of militaristic imperialism and signaled their eventual downfall. The Venice Biennale, which you may be very familiar with today, is one of the most prestigious international exhibitions of contemporary art that takes place every other summer, is also one of the oldest of the now countless international art biennials. The Biennale came about as a means of nation building. Even before its inception in 1895, Italy was concerned with finding innovative ways to form and strengthen its national identity. As art and culture had long defined the greatness of Italy, from the Roman Empire to the Renaissance, cultural forums such as art exhibitions had always been an ideal means of redefining and representing the country's values and displaying those values for the whole country and the world to see. In 1883, the Fifth Artistic Congress in Rome invited Venice to host a national art exhibition, conceived as a means to help unify Italy and overcome its traditional regionalism. And what I mean by that is that Italy, only unified in 1861, had long identified itself not as a nation, but by its many regions. And here you can see two maps of Italy prior to unification in 1861 on the left and after unification on the right, and you can see how the map is kind of divided by these regions of Tuscany and Lombardy and Campania, and people in Italy had really identified themselves not so much as Italians, but say Tuscans and Florentines or Neapolitans rather than Italians. So this was something that was very much part of the agenda of these kinds of exhibitions, to create this kind of unification as a nation. So the National Exhibition opened in 1887 in the city's giardini, or gardens. There, 23 galleries, which were built for the occasion, attracted the many artists who regularly visited Venice for its visual beauty and artistic inspiration, as well as intellectuals and politicians, such as the mayor of Venice, Riccardo Selvatico, who later became the first president of the Biennale. In 1895, on the occasion of the 25th anniversary of King Umberto I and Queen Margherita of Savoy, the Biennale di Venezia, again the International Exhibition of Art of the City of Venice, replaced the National Art Exhibition, celebrating a newly united Italy. The committees and subcommittees in charge recommended that within one pavilion, the exhibition would consist of recognized Italian artists, international artists of significant reputation, and a small number of unsolicited and juried works. An executive subcommittee of 7 people brought together 37 European academic artists who comprised the International Committee of Patronage. The most prominent leaders of the subcommittee were the most receptive to artists outside of Venice and pursued painters such as Gustave Moreau, whose work you can see on the left, and John Singer Sargent, whose work is on the right, to serve on this committee of patronage. Such openness to foreign creativity, albeit academic, distinguished the Biennale from the former National Art Exhibition and became the source of the exhibition's greatest strength in its later development. As Salvatico declared, the exhibition would represent, quote, the most noble activities of the modern spirit without distinction of country, end quote. Although from its beginnings, the Biennale proclaimed itself to be a forum for cultural diplomacy and displaying foreign art, its international scope and embrace of modern art was relatively limited from 1895 to 1926. The aesthetic preferences of Antonio Fradelletto, the first Secretary General, were generally conservative, academic, and slow to admit modern art. The Biennale under Vittorio Pica, the Secretary General in the post-war years 1920 to 1926, was international but hardly contemporary, demonstrating his hesitance to embrace the avant-garde. The exhibition was European-focused, which reflected the sensibility of the time. 15 countries from Western and Northern Europe, plus Russia and the United States, exhibited in the central building in the first Biennale. The United States was the only non-European country, and American artists like Isabel Ross, who presented her work in the early Biennales, did not even live abroad. She lived in Venice, which is very evident from this work. In 1897, Japan, the first non-Western country, joined, and in 1901, Hungarian and Croatian artists made their debut. As of 1914, 19 nations were represented with their own pavilions. The push to simultaneously modernize and nationalize, appealing to both conservatives and progressives, would begin in earnest in 1928, when the fascist regime removed the autonomy of the Biennale and placed it under state control. So again, initially, the Biennale was founded as an institution of the city of Venice. In 1928, it becomes really a national exhibition under the control of the fascist regime. The fascists, led by Benito Mussolini from 1919 through his death in 1945, focused on regenerating a corrupt Italy through cultural, political, and military means. In his aggressive quest to reconstruct and redefine his country, Mussolini saw the arts, and eventually the Biennale, as a way to win the support of the masses and establish international admiration and supremacy. During the first half of the 1920s, Mussolini restructured his administration to pave the road for such change. He introduced art-educated party personnel into cultural production and supported open, public discussions about the definitions of fascist art to win the favor of intellectuals, artists, and the masses. Giuseppe Bottai, the, quote, liberal fascist, appointed Minister of Corporations and National Education, upheld that fascism should not propagate aesthetics, an art of the state, nor discriminate based on aesthetic choices. By permitting and supporting so many styles, Mussolini hoped to counter, as one art historian has noted, quote, the prevailing view of fascist aesthetics as entirely provincial and retrograde, end quote. Such creative freedom, however, was in effect a type of propaganda. It was best put to use under a new law signed on December 24, 1928, by King Vittorio Emanuele III and Mussolini, by which the Biennale had become an autonomous entity of the state. And here is, again, that poster from the first year of the Biennale being under fascist control, allowing the fascists to put the arts under increasing government control. Under the leadership of the new Secretary General, Antonio Madaini, and with the collaboration of the artist-politician Filippo Tommaso Marinetti, the Biennale would be transformed into a propagandistic platform for exhibiting Italian creative genius and tradition, national identity, and contemporary life. The first Futurist Manifesto of 1909, written by Marinetti and published on the front page of the Parisian newspaper Le Figaro on February 20th of that year, proclaimed a burning desire, fueled by industry, war, and the machine, to race into the future. Tired of resting on the laurels of the Roman Empire and the Renaissance, and disdainful of their uneventful past, the Futurists called for a new aesthetic language appropriate for the new modernity. Instead of continuing to define their cultural glory through the lens of the ancient, weighty, and static, they exalted the moment. The present was the time for discovery and forging ahead through violent movement, feverish activity, and speed. As painters, sculptors, poets, and performers, The futurists detach themselves from the history of art by wholehearted participation in contemporary life. They infused Italian art with a vibrancy that brimmed with the spirit of modern times. Inspired by the multiplicity of perspectives that life in the 20th century offered, they evoked the colors of imagined cities and of life in motion. With the advent of modern transportation, people traveled with unprecedented speeds and perceived objects around them with a new awareness. Umberto Boccioni, one of the leading artists of this first wave of pre-World War I futurism, expressed that explosive energy in his States of Mind, which is actually on view upstairs on the fifth floor. And this is the first painting in the series of three entitled The Farewells. And you can see kind of the movement of the modern city, this explosive energy. It's all really kind of coming off of the canvas. There are all these very bright colors, the reds, the yellows, the blues. In the middle, you can see this kind of object of futurist fascination, which is the train, really locomotion. And you can see, kind of perhaps difficult to identify, but here's a kind of smokestack of the train, and it's actually repeated twice again here. And you can see these kind of clouds billowing out of these smokestacks. And Boccioni is representing this train two times to show the progress of this object through space and time. So it's moving literally from point A to point B, and it gets closer to us as it moves forward. And all of this energy kind of expands out and throughout the entire canvas. And you can also see these kinds of green figures that are painted throughout the canvas. They're actually human figures. And you can see that really clearly, I think, in this example here. There's this face, maybe a mother with her arms embracing this child. Again, these are all repeated just to kind of show the movement and how even human beings are kind of swept up in the excitement and the movement of the modern environment that's really being, overwhelmed in a certain way by modern transportation. And this is actually the second painting in Boccioni's series, States of Mind, called Those Who Go, in which we can see how these figures, very represented very differently from the green figures we just saw, are also being transported by this movement. They're actually on this moving train, and they are passing the landscape behind them so quickly that it blurs. These are these houses, this kind of the Mediterranean glow of these houses that are kind of fragmented through the windows, these kind of square shapes over here. The interiors and the exteriors blur. They really kind of integrate because, again, the awareness that humans have now with the advent of this kind of transportation completely changes and alters our outlook on the world. So just to make a clear distinction, the futurist artists are, for the most part, concerned with depicting objects in motion. So, again, transportation. If you go again to the fifth floor, you'll see other works by Boccioni or Balla or Severini, and their subjects are, for example, soccer players, dancers in a dance hall, a scene of anarchism, a bird in flight. So their interest, again, are moving objects. And we can compare that to the cubists, who are also working at the same time at the beginning of the 1900s, and artists like Picasso and Braque are actually representing still objects. So this is a still life called Violin and Grapes from 1912, also in MoMA's collection. They have a similar interest in representing objects from diverse points of views and breaking down these forms in fragments. But again, the aesthetic, the intention is very, very different. So again, locomotion was one of the focal points of futurism, both in its pre- and post-World War I phases. It was actually the car, however, that was the regenerative means by which Marinetti was born a futurist. Thrilled by the speed of the machine, unattainable through pure human energy, Marinetti, in the early years of futurism, ended up in a car crash. After the accident, he wrote, and again, remember, he's also a poet, quote, "Oh, maternal ditch, almost full of muddy water, fair factory drain, I gulped down your nourishing sludge, and I remembered the blessed black breast of my Sudanese nurse when I came up, torn, filthy, and stinking from under the capsized car. I felt the white-hot iron of joy deliciously pass through my heart." end quote. The resulting disaster ironically gave him a new life as a fear-loving futurist. Marinetti saw the car as a transformative machine, a futurist symbol of the love of danger and energy, courage and audacity, rebellion and velocity. He proclaimed in his futurist manifesto, quote, "We affirm that the magnificence of the world is enriched by a new beauty, the beauty of velocity. A race car with its bonnet adorned with great tubes like a serpent with explosive breath. A rumbling car that seems to run on machine gun fire is more beautiful than the victory of Samothrace." And we can see that, which is now in the Louvre, a classic example of beauty made in about 190 BC. So to compare this kind of idea of beauty to the car, something we don't traditionally consider really kind of aesthetically beautiful. Some people think of it as aesthetically beautiful, but we might not consider it in the realm of art. A perfect modern machine, the car was, quote, "the vehicle with which the past would be overthrown," end quote. In the post-World War I period, the airplane, an even more advanced representation of technology and progress, became futurism's primary concern. However, as early as futurism's founding in 1909, the airplane was a subject of national fascination. It soon came to embody the modern society that Marinetti, through aero painting, which I'll get to soon, and later the fascists envisioned. The Futurist Manifesto concluded with an aspiration to conquer the heavens. Quote, "Upwards to the top of the world we climb, one more time our challenge to the stars," end quote. In the same year, Marinetti had climbed aboard an aircraft in Brescia at the first international air meet. From that point on, he relied on aviation to convey, from aesthetics and language to war, propaganda and national supremacy, a futurist way of life. Many years later, and in many ways, Mussolini and Marinetti seemed to be political and aesthetic mirrors to one another. They each propagated a modern outlook while trying to destroy what they perceived to be the weaknesses of the past. They shared excitement for the revitalizing potential of technology that reflected Italy's modern consciousness, redefined themselves through aviation, and upheld the importance of Italian regeneration and tradition. As a result, they relied on each other to build support for and within their movements. Despite occasional conflicting political approaches, their shared interest in militarism and national renewal led the two groups to establish an official relationship as early as 1919. While pre-war futurism defined itself by a new vision of the future, the so-called second futurists, members of the original group as well as artists new to the movement, saw that industrial and technological development and a fast-paced urban environment, all of which the first futurists had years before identified as the electric future, was quickly becoming a part of everyday life. Though the airplane had enthralled Marinetti as a poet in the pre-war period, it became a defining characteristic of futurism in the 30s. Aeropittura, or aero painting, was born on September 22, 1929, with Marinetti's publication of Mino Somenzi's Manifesto of Aeropittura. It proclaimed the futurist abandonment of earthly perspectives for those of the divine skies through two principal tendencies: an aeropittura that imagined outer space, expressing the occult forces of cosmic idealism, as seen here on the left in a painting by Enrico Prampolini, and one made immediate by the impressions of flight, as seen in another on the right by Tullio Cralli. Prampolini, as we can see, uses a much more abstract approach. He renders the earth with textures and appearances of rocks and dirt right here. And he also infuses the picture with the cosmic and the divine. Again, this kind of light that infuses the picture seems to represent this agenda that they have of representing aerial perspectives and the pilot and this new view from above through a divine point of view. And these lines over here, perhaps we can think of as tracing some sort of movement, and perhaps it's aerial, a kind of tracing of movement from above. Cralli's painting, on the other hand, is much more realistic, as he created a recognizable image of a pilot descending dramatically upon a futuristic city. The thrill comes not only from the steep perspective, but also from the fact that the only protective structure surrounding the pilot is the frame of the airplane. You can see here these kind of black forms, which are the frame of the airplane, but The windows are so transparent that they seem invisible. The pilot becomes a part of the urban fabric, fragmented by divine light again. The rhetoric of Ero Pittura was that of the regime and thus guaranteed fascist backing. And here you can see Mussolini in the 1920s when he began to take flying lessons and became an agent of fascist propaganda himself. The futurists and the fascists perceived aviation as an embodiment of modern life and a means to a superior nation. Exalting the cosmic vision of the pilot, the age of the airplane in art and politics would replace old bourgeois society with a youthful culture that would challenge the limits of time, space, and national tradition. Freed from what they thought of as the burdensome, quote, inevitable scum of the past, end quote, the artists intended to rise above reality and dominate it, to see or dream of it in new ways. Through this process, the futurist became a vehicle for divine movement, elevating man, multiplying his strength, and creating a new spirit of the epic. As a result, they and the Italian people would soar ahead, progressing faster than its European neighbors. In the 1926 Biennale, Marinetti had presented the first inkling of Ero themes in the futurist visual arts. And again, I just want to distinguish, for those of you who don't necessarily speak Italian, Maraini is the secretary general of the Biennale at this time, and Marinetti is the futurist leader. So they're very, Maraini, Marinetti, they're very similar last names, so I just want you to get the distinction. Prominently displayed was Fedele Azzari's Perspectives of Flight, which unfortunately I don't have an image of, which was denoted as the first Ero painting. However, no other work showed the futurist obsession with all things related to the sky. Many works communicated the synthesis and velocity inherent to futurism. Others clearly marked the beginning of a new political aesthetic alliance, like Pippo Rizzo's Futurism and Fascism, or Prampolini's Mussolini, Plastic Synthesis. Paintings from the 1926 exhibition, here's an installation shot, represented the lyrical biomorphism and the scientific order that would characterize Ero Pittura in the 1930s. We saw this relationship already in the works by Prampolini and Kralli, again, the lyrical biomorphism here and the more kind of scientific order in this one. And we see it again in works like Gerardo Dottori's Flora on the left, voluminous and solid with a classical face, but futuristically vibrant in color, which you can see, and ethereal form. And Ivo Panaggi's In Architectural Function on the right, which creates an aerial perspective of geometric and architectural forms that sit contained on and fit into, like puzzle pieces, a solid hovering square. We can also see the dichotomy of lyricism and precision in the 1928 show in works like Giovanni Varvaro's City plus Night Reflectors on the left and Vittorio Corona's Marina plus Sea Sirens on the right. Again, these are works that are originally in color. From 1928 through the 1930s, Maraini increasingly restricted the Biennale's international scope by emphasizing a narrowly defined Italianità, a combination of Italian sensibility and nationality. Again, that poster you saw before from 1928 and another one from 1930. The 1928 exhibitions at the Biennale exalted tradition, contemporary life, and above all, a state-identified art. Maraini's vehement distaste for French art, his removal of international artists from the galleries of the Italian Pavilion, the principal exhibition space, in 1930, and his emphasis on Italian regional identities and national tradition reflected fascism's obsession with power and competition. In 1930, the Biennale awarded artists for works that best communicated the fascist way of life, with images representing the Duce, agricultural work, the family, the vigor of the Italian race, sports, and other state-run activities. And here is an example of art embracing sport and virility in the 1930 exhibition. Marinetti took such ideals of Italian cultural strength on the road, exemplifying how propaganda could promote both an artistic group's as well as the regime's goal of international recognition. Italian identity, like a product packaged by a futurist machine, became an item of consumption, merchandise to export. In addition to having his writings translated in countries from France to Argentina and Japan, Marinetti organized exhibitions of Ero Pittura in Berlin, Paris, and Athens, attended conferences, and did futurist performances. In the 1932 Biennale catalog, he wrote, quote, Ero Pittura is conquering all of the European publics, end quote. Such propaganda became a model for the fascists. Once the Biennale was established as a fascist institution in 1928, Giuseppe Volpi di Misurata, the president of the Biennale, oversaw the export of many exhibitions to foreign countries. Through these international shows and reporters' trips abroad, Italians affirmed their assumptions about the superiority of their nation and the viability of their form of modernity, denouncing others in the process. The 1930 Biennale program, for example, criticized Parisian culture for its, quote, cosmopolitanism, voracious interests, and morose ambitions, end quote. The 1932 Biennale, which commemorated the 10th anniversary of Mussolini's March on Rome, occupied itself exclusively of Italian national art, dismissing international views of modernism. Maraini also stipulated that foreign art, now absent from the Italian pavilion, could only be exhibited in the national pavilions. And these are separate buildings where each nation can kind of curate its own exhibition of works of art by that nation's artists. Such a move reflected both the isolationism of Italian culture and at the same time the tolerance and existence of, as it were, national subcultures. In effect, the pre-World War II biennales came to be about Italian art, leaving the national pavilions as an afterthought. Maraini focused his attentions instead on awarding prizes for works that represented and glorified events and conquests of the Anno Dieci, or the Year 10, which is, again, commemorating the 10th year of the 10th anniversary of Mussolini's March on Rome, like Dottori's painting of the same name, which won the Ministry of Corporations Prize. Dottori depicts this architectural form right in the middle, actually, right here. It's literally the building, the construction of fascism in its 10 years of existence, as well as machine parts of airplanes here, you can see. And architectural details of Italian cities. Up here you can see the Rialto in Venice, again showing the importance of the regional identities, the parts of Italy that make it so famous for, you know, its international recognition, for tourism, for its kind of international appeal. And again, he uses these fragments of divine light as well. You can see even in the back this kind of big horizon line and sun. Thematic shows that were organized in the second decade of fascism, such as the International Retrospective Exhibition of the 19th Century Landscape in 1938, prove that international presence at the Biennale existed to further a fascist goal, that of proving Italy's cultural superiority. The exhibition could have had the potential to show the universal significance of landscape painting and show the diverse trends and approaches to the subject by artists from around the world. However, the exhibitions revealed the ever-conservative sensibility that pervaded Italian life and politics. Loyal to the ideal of the, quote, re-sanitizing of art, end quote, in 1934, and using words and phrases like force, universal competition, and race throughout the 1930s, Maraini imposed the rhetoric of war and cultural imperialism upon the exhibitions and the works of art. The Biennale defined itself by belligerently promoting Italy's standing not only in the artistic and cultural world, but eventually in the military and colonial world too. Reflecting this anti-cosmopolitan ideology, the works in Marinetti's 1930 New Futurist Painting Exhibition represented regional landscapes that exalted local Italian identity and imperialistic nationalism. The futurists positioned themselves against what Marinetti described as the French's, quote, cold and arbitrary monotony, end quote. Prampolini depicted the futurist and fascist fascination with family, the duce, and local identity in paintings entitled Maternity, Mussolini, and Synthesis of Naples. Benedetta, who was a very important futurist artist and actually Marinetti's wife, revealed the importance of nature's rhythms and simultaneity with her abstracted, volumetric yet dynamic forms, rhythm of the rocks and sea. Tato's Arioplani, which received the National Fascist Confederation of the People of the Sea and Air Prize at that year's Biennale, glorified the perspective from above. More in vogue than ever during the years leading up to and during World War II, the Edo painters at the 1934 Biennale asserted positions that were more aggressive than in previous years on race and national supremacy, cultural divinity, and geographic conquest. And you can actually see in these paintings right in the front the kind of enormity of these airplanes. They really kind of are very imposing. In the exhibition of Italian futurist aeropainters, Marinetti equated national tradition and race with artistic genius in order to prove the viability of aeropainting to the public, critics, and the regime. He portrayed his artists as inheritors of quasi-divine Italian customs. In his 1934 essay, he assured his public of the, quote, unimportant occasional contacts or contaminations that have occurred between the avant-gardes and unpatriotic or Marxist Judaism, end quote, affirming his distance as a superior Italian from the Jews, whom Mussolini later denounced. Race within Italy had always been a source of contention, which is why using it to wield cultural authority posed so many problems. Whereas, as I mentioned before, historically, Italians were either categorized as Southerners or Northerners or by their region, they were now, for the sake of imperialism, all Italians united by the goal of exporting their national identity and expanding their empire. Attention to class and regional conflict shifted to unity in order to regenerate the nation. To counter international criticism of Italy's disunity and lack of national integration, the futurists too developed an art that would resonate across the regions, landscapes, and languages of their own country. From the beginning of the 1930s, futurist groups formed in various cities such as Turin, Milan, Venice, Florence, and Rome. In addition to painting aerial perspectives of colonial aspirations and conquests in East Africa for the rest of the decade and into the 1940s, the aeropainters helped disseminate modern art throughout Italy with their paintings of bird's-eye views of lakes, mountains, and cities that define specific regions of the country. Memories of Capri in the south, which is over here, Umbria in central Italy, and La Spezia in the north filled their canvases. In 1934, Marinetti Somenzi and Angelo Mazzoni published the Futurist Manifesto of Aerial Architecture. The Futurists published hundreds of manifestos. Actually, if you're interested, the library upstairs has an amazing collection. It has basically all of the manifestos, and you can go look and see what they were all about. In it, they proclaimed that futurism's new view from above via aero painting and colonial warplanes disintegrated boundaries between regions, landscapes, and cities, creating a unified whole. They wrote, "The highways will also abolish every regionalism, parochialism, and ruralism, and will give to Italy a unique city made of continuous lines of velocity, health, joy of living, truly worthy of fascist aviation and of its leader, Benito Mussolini. Beneath us, we will have, like brilliant roads shining from the quiet explosion of the resplendent letters of this word, from the Alps to Mogadishu, Italy." End quote. Through this dynamic synthesis, Pippo Oriani produced works like Interplanetary Landscape, blurring the distinction between sky and ground, the intangible and the physical. Two silhouettes of an airplane, as you can see here, imprint themselves on the ground and impose themselves upon the landscape. Without traditional perspective, the airplane, the geometric shapes, and the organic forms that suggest nature become a part of the same flat, regimented surface. Such mystical paintings, evoking the natural, the cosmic, and thus the divine, praised and legitimized colonialism, territorial expansion, and the ensuing explosive violence. As they considered themselves the greater race, Italians gave themselves the authority to transform the landscape of Ethiopia when they invaded in 1935. For totalitarian regimes governed by aggression and compensatory inferiority complexes, mechanized combat was a conduit to divinity and to, quote, eternal principles of morality, right, and religion, end quote. Italy upheld the great myth of national regeneration, that war, a collective test of discipline and sacrifice, was a means of, quote, knowing whether we are a nation, end quote, as the publication La Voce stated as early as 1914 at the start of World War I. The invasion of Ethiopia provided great inspiration for the last years of futurism. Marinetti increasingly began to portray futurists as artist combatants whose artistic strategies echoed military ones. Although Marinetti had participated in World War I and had transcribed the sounds of war in Tripoli into poetry like Zang Tum Tum, The war in Africa in the mid-30s brought to life his fantasies about the hygienic cleansing of an even more destructive war, one of, quote, ultra-deadly perfect mechanisms, end quote. Marinetti and the futurist Mario Menin's firsthand experiences of war provoked new approaches to making art. Menin, a black shirt who fought in Ethiopia in 1936, became Marinetti's champion, expressing the dynamism of combat, considering the explosions of African battle as lyrical, and conveying the forms of crashes and the echoes of cannons and machine guns in works with the expressive titles Velocity of Tanks and Dust in Tembien and Airplanes Fire at the Chimbarbo. The spiritual aspects of Aero painting always provided a balance to works by artists like Menin, legitimizing the violent fervor of war from a divine point of view. Instead of conveying explosive war, Dottori's Monumental depicts a cosmic place that elicits life on another planet. In his adoration, Filia reduces his landscape to its essence and infuses it with spirituality. Like outstretched wings, the cross, cosmic, primitive, and religious, becomes a sign for an airplane, the object of adoration. Not only did 1936 signal a dramatic transition in Aero Pittura, thanks to Italy's presence in Ethiopia, but it also marked significant political alliances and cultural misalliances. In the same year that fascism and Nazism allied themselves, three countries withdrew from the Biennale. Maraini continued to assert Italy's cultural strength and dismissed foreign absence as meaningless. Of course, countries such as the U.S. and the Soviet Union withdrew for domestic and mostly political reasons, the invasion of Ethiopia, while the League of Nations had imposed economic sanctions against Italy. Abstention from the Biennale was thus a form of cultural boycott. The regime claimed that Italy's new cultural exchanges with Japan, Spain, and Germany rivaled the League of Nations. Pursuing further isolationism, Italy expanded its autarky campaign, which had begun in the 1920s. Following the League's sanctions, Italy proclaimed greater economic self-sufficiency. It required all Italian industries to use only native resources, such as aluminum, coal, steel, and synthetic fuels, all of which supposedly proved Italy's preparedness for war. Alongside the reduced opportunities for cultural exchange, international economic exchange vanished. Marinetti incorporated autarky into his practice, too. In his essay on the 1938 exhibition, Futurist Aero Painters of Africa and Spain, Marinetti wrote of the Aero painters, quote, "They who invented the word foreign-loving, not to denigrate foreign production, but to defend, value, and prefer Italian production, guarantee today more than ever the necessary autarky of our poetry and art," end quote. While intent on being a part of the international avant-garde, the futurists followed the fascists in requiring an inward-looking Italian art. Such isolation, whether economic or cultural, and consequent foreign imposition, were the best means to fortify identity. Italy's entrance into World War II as Germany's ally in 1940 signaled the beginning of the downfall of futurism, fascism, and their ideologies of national renewal. The futurists and the fascists' persistent desire to prove their divinity, immortality, or at least the power of their movements to endure over time, ensured the actual demise of their movements. Indifferent to the harm of technology when abused, the two groups alienated large sectors of its own population as well as the international community. Although they envisioned the machine fostering collective spirits and desires, the futurists and the fascists' dehumanization of life through the machine in art and war became so extreme that neither culture nor combat could function any longer as humanitarian tools of persuasion. This unsustainable dichotomy of culture and war came to a head at the last fascist Biennale of 1942. With the end of the war came the end of fascism and the end of the second futurist at the Biennale. When the Biennale reopened in 1948, Italy had to give birth to a new institution as well as a new nation. With 14 countries participating, it could not resume as a political tool. The imperialistic overtones of the 30s were clearly inappropriate to a defeated country. The new Secretary General and Special Commissioner aimed to create a new climate of liberty and ensure the openness and education inherent to the Biennale. For once, the post-war Biennale established that, quote, "amongst different peoples, there are no races or competitions, if not for the preeminence of the beautiful and the good." Thank you. So if anybody has any questions, yes.
I'm just curious, I'm obviously not Italian, but does Feininger fit into this in any way, with this geometric kind of cities?
He's not a futurist, but I mean, certainly there are actually, he as well as other artists certainly are interested in this kind of fragmentation of form. Again, as I showed you, the futurist, there's also a Russian, the cubist before, there's also a Russian futurist movement that happens about the same time. They're also interested in kind of industry and the machine and transportation, but they have a very different aesthetic and approach to the work. There's a movement called in Britain called Vorticism, which has a similar aesthetic to Feininger and to the Futurists, in that they use these kind of bright colors and fragmented forms that seem to be kind of intersected by this light. So, but he wasn't related to the Futurists.
But he was influenced by them?
I'm not really sure. I'm not an expert on him. So I'm probably not the best person to answer that question. Sure. Yes.
You talked about fascism and stress and degenerative Italy as a country. And then you talked about regionalism. And how do you combine the two? Isn't the stress on the regions inconsistent with the idea of Italy as a unitary body?
Well, that's a really good question. As I mentioned before, Italy has historically had this kind of problem of being identified by its regions as opposed to a nation, and the Biennale was this attempt to kind of unify Italy. At the same time, Maraini, who was the Secretary General, installed exhibitions in the main pavilion that were organized by kind of regions. I think the intent in that was to show the different kinds of beauty and the variety, the kind of diversity of culture, all of these kinds of appealing things. I think he was trying to show off Italy's different regions as Italy's varied attributes. You know, we have mountains, we have lakes, we have cities, we have all different kinds of culture. But I think you're right. I think it's a very difficult thing to reconcile as they're also attempting to create this this kind of vision of unity. Yeah.
Were there any other art movements in Italy at the time, or were they all suppressed?
There were, actually. Mussolini had a Jewish lover, ironically enough, named Margherita Sarfatti, and she was the head of a group called the Novecento, which basically means like the 1900s, and they were a group of artists who depicted, had a very completely different aesthetic than the Futurists. This kind of return to the classical, very heavy, voluminous forms, in old kind of rural landscapes. And actually, the Novecento and the Futurists vied with the fascist regime to become the official art of the state. Mussolini, in the end, never elected one of them to be an official art of the state. He never elected any movement or artist or aesthetic to be the official aesthetic of the state. Yet they both kind of had these very close relationships with the regime. There were also other movements like De Chirico, whose work is also up on the fifth floor. He was considered a metaphysical painter, using kind of scientific objects, also this kind of juxtaposition between the past and the future, and kind of representing his own turmoil, his own kind of trouble with dealing with the impact of industrialization on kind of old beauty of Italy. So yes, and there's Giorgio Morandi. There were a lot of other Italian painters who were also exhibited in the Italian pavilion at the time, but Mussolini actually guaranteed the Futurists their own exhibition at the Biennale from 1928 to 1942. Yeah.
What kind of things are being shown in the National Pavilion?
That's a good question. I mean, each of the National Pavilions had their own kind of administration. It wasn't part of the fascist regime, Maraini. They didn't really have any say over what got exhibited in those pavilions. The French government, the Austrian government, all these governments had their own kind of cultural attaches, cultural departments to determine that. But you know, certainly in the beginning of the 1900s, you know, Impressionism and Post-Impressionism were exhibited, artists like Moreau and Sargent. I mean, there was really a wide variety, but again, there was this attempt to display works that reflected the time. Yeah.
There were three countries that had withdrawn in 1936. Mm-hmm. You mentioned two. Who was
yep.
the third?
France.
Oh, okay. And in 1942, the 14, I mean, maybe this is...
Yeah, I would have to go back and check exactly what the 14 were.
Where can one see... I mean, I'm not familiar with some of these artists. Mm-hmm. Where can one see these...
It's hard. Actually, MoMA doesn't own any of the works of the Second Futurist. I think in part, I think it's a kind of problematic period of art because it's so overshadowed by fascism. So MoMA's collection is very strong in the First Futurist. Many other collections are strong in the First Futurist. There's actually a museum in London called the Esterick Collection. And they actually have a number of these kind of second futurist works of art. In terms of others, I'm not even really sure. It's been very difficult for me to find images, know in what collections they're in now. Yes?
In the 39 World's Fair, did the Italian Pavilion emphasize futurism and the art they decided to export here?
That's a good question. I'm not sure, but I would think that they would have, again, because they were so much on the kind of international circuit trying to promote their work abroad.
A quick second question. If you eliminate futurism as a style, but just look at the subjects they emphasize, mm-hmm. can we say that really they were not very atypical for the 30s, that many countries, Russia, Germany, even the United States, to some extent, also emphasize some of the same subjects?
Sure. Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's right. I think a lot of artists were really consumed, again, by kind of what was happening in everyday life, by technology and transportation and this concern for cultural and national advance.
WPA, I think a lot of their paintings emphasize sort of a national American image. You know,
sure. Absolutely. Yeah, there's a lot of nationalism at the time in all different countries. Yeah, absolutely. Anything else? Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming.